Thursday, July 16th, right here on Connecticut Today. We talked state politics in the 3 o'clock hour. Liz Karandowitz joined us from the TV version of the Capitol Report every Sunday morning on News 8. Liz and I discussed what's going on in the state now, politics-wise, and what portends for the special sessions and the November election cycle. And in the 4 o'clock hour, we brought you the latest comments from Governor Ned Lamont, including details as to how the state is still going to try and reopen schools in August.
You should be watching the Capitol Report on News 8 WTNH every Sunday morning at 10. And among the panelists there is Liz Karandowitz, who makes her debut here, I believe, on Connecticut Today. Hey, Liz. Paul here. How are you?
I'm well, sir. How are you?
I'm okay. I mean, I'm all right. I get up in the morning. I can, feel the floor under my feet. I can find the light switch. So at my age, it's all good, It's all good.
It sounds pretty good to me.
I can't complain. That's where I am. Liz, let's take a look at what's going on at the Capitol. I guess tomorrow is when we have something, Liz, that's supposed to resemble a public hearing regarding, the big elephant in the room now, which, of course, is this police reform bill. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think it'll be interesting to see how the public hearing process works itself out in the age of COVID and pandemic policymaking, right? This is the first time that a substantive issue will have been debated at the state capitol since the beginning part of March. Mm. And so it'll be interesting to see what the public participation looks like. I know that the ranking members on the Republican side and the Democrat chairs have really tried to get out and solicit opinions and feedback and have this be as broad of an approach as possible. I think as Connecticut residents, we should all be proud of the fact that both parties came together to try and tackle something that's really difficult and do it together. When you look at the way this was done in Washington, D.C., you had a very partisan approach,
mm-hmm. yeah.
right? Senator Tim Scott wrote his bill without Democrat support. And Democrats in the House ran through their bill mm-hmm. without engaging the other side. So I think Connecticut's doing it the right way so far.
Yeah, I had Rosa Rabimbus and Steve Stastrom, the leaders and the ranking member of the Judiciary Committee on earlier in the week, Liz, and they both told me that they really thought that there was a good chance that a broad bunch of what's in those, what's in that framework bill that I know you've undoubtedly have looked at, and we've all looked at here. Some of those are no-brainers. The big part of that is a no-brainer. My guess is, consent searches, you may have a, debate on. I think use of force, you're going to have a lot of debate on, as well. So I don't think this is going to be, completely kumbaya, but we may be on the road to kumbaya a little bit anyway.
Sure. Well, I think having debate on the issues is really important. And I think things that they can't come to resolution on, they may be able to at least get something accomplished in the near term that makes an immediate difference. And that's why you do a special session. You do a special session to make an immediate impact on policy outcomes. This is not for large policy initiatives and see changes in large scope, right? A special session is intended to be special, right? And intended to have a big impact on a necessary policy outcome as quickly as possible. And so I think they are all to be applauded for tackling these things. And there's that hopefully the debate will lead to better outcomes for everybody.
Liz Karandowitz is the guest from the Capitol Report, Sunday mornings, News 8. Liz, hang on. We'll be right back with you. More with Liz straight ahead. First, traffic and weather together, 3:36 on a Thursday at WICC. Talking some state politics, we talked earlier in the week with legislative leaders Steve Stastrom of Bridgeport and Rosa Rabimbus of Naugatuck regarding what's coming up at the Capitol in what may be actually two special sessions. You never know. And then the regular session after elections. Tossing that around is one of the panelists from the Capitol Report on News 8 Sunday morning. Liz Karandowitz is the guest for a few more minutes. Liz, you know, beyond the one special session, maybe two, I think a lot of people forget there's an election coming up in November. So I mean, everybody's tied in with COVID right now and Trump and the national stuff. But, you know, 36 seats in the state Senate, 151 in the state House. So, God, you know what, Liz, I'm so wondering what's going to happen here. Is there going to be another anti-Trump effect that may nail Republicans? I mean, what do you think? I'm still trying to figure this whole thing out.
Well, look, I mean, I think when you see what's happening, there are so many unknowns here in how we're going to vote. We don't know what Connecticut's going to look like 3-4 weeks from now in terms of COVID. And so certainly with November, first week in November rolling around, we're unsure what that looks like. Mm-hmm. But you can be sure that presidential politics, as always, will play a major role, as they always have, right? I mean, certainly to your point, Republicans did not fare as well as we had hoped in the 2018 midterm elections. But that's pretty standard for a midterm of a president. When you look back during the Obama years, Democrats lost a lot of seats in the Connecticut legislature, right? I mean, Republicans doubled their membership in the state house during the Obama administration.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then likewise, when you look at the presidential election from 2016, Republicans picked up 8 seats in the House and 3 in the Senate. So it's hard to see where the trend lines are. Certainly, the big difference between 2016 and 2020 is that the 2016 election largely was, even though it was an open seat, you had Donald Trump, who was an unknown political entity, right? Running against a very known Hillary Clinton in the political sphere. And so this time it's going to be a referendum on Donald Trump, even though Joe Biden is has been around politics a lot longer. This will certainly be a Trump referendum. So it'll be interesting to see how that affects Republican turnout, how it affects Democrat turnout. And all of that, obviously, it trickles down to the legislative races. And so with people unsure about how they're going to get to the polls, if they're voting by mail, I think it's a good year for incumbents, which would then lend itself to not be a great year for Republicans necessarily. However, Republican candidates who had won previously but lost in 2018, many of them are coming back again. So they're known quantities in their communities, and people are familiar with their name and know the kind of legislators that they are. So that could prove beneficial.
Who do you think, Liz, steps up, you know, with Len Fasano leaving the GOP stewardship in the Senate and, you know, Themis Clarida stepping aside for now? We all know about the rumblings of a gubernatorial run from Themis in 2 years. Who do you think in each chamber, Liz, steps up for the GOP?
So the race in the Senate, in the Republican state Senate, is down to two senators, as far as I understand it. Mm-hmm. Senator Kevin Witkos, who's from the Farmington Valley area, Canton, up that way. And then Senator Kevin Kelly from Stratford. It seems to be a horse race between those two. Unsure about what that outcome looks like. But either way, I don't think you see a huge sea change in tone and temperament and anything like that coming out of the Republican Senate. And in the House, all arrows are currently pointing towards House Republican Deputy Leader Vin Candelora taking over the helm upon Themis's departure. So, and the good thing is that all of these people have been part of the inner workings of policy decision making over the course of the last several years, which is important because one thing, but whether it's Len and Themis, Joe Arasimowitz obviously is leaving as Speaker, and so arrows are pointing to Matt Ritter taking over as Speaker at the moment. And so the race is really on for majority leader there. So you have three new faces, as it were, taking over leadership of the caucuses, which will bring some change and a different approach, certainly. But the good thing is all of these leaders have been part of the leadership team over the course of the last several years, which is important because this group of leaders together has accomplished some really big things for our state. Mm-hmm. And so there will be some continuity in the sense that this isn't a whole green team coming in.
Liz Karanowicz is the guest for a few more minutes. You see her Sunday mornings on the Capitol Report on News 8. Ned Lamont, Liz, you know, I know he's taken some slings and arrows for some of the stuff he's done and hasn't done during the whole COVID-19 thing, and I just didn't know what he was doing previous on the whole toll thing, and that'll probably be birthed again after the elections for the regular session. But, you know, Liz, I have to tell you, separating the policy from the governor's, the way he carries himself, I think he has been a welcome change in it, just the tone, Liz, that he has brought back to the governor's chair, the big chair, whatever that is, the big leather chair probably, and the governor's residence, because as you and I both know, the previous occupant of that home for 8 years was not big on, you know, kumbaya tea, you know, niceties, shall we say. So I like the tone, at least. Don't you think that the Governor Lamont has set a little bit?
Well, he's certainly a different leader style than Malloy had. And I think he's been the beneficiary of the fact that Malloy is still very unpopular in Connecticut. And I think a lot of people still blame the Governor Malloy for the state of our state. And so regardless, I think voters felt good about the fact that no matter what, Dan Malloy was no longer going to be in charge of Connecticut. So I think that was going to be helpful for whoever became governor, right?
Yeah.
But I do think the governor is to be commended for having a different tone and certainly being far less caustic, shall we say.
Caustic's a good word, Liz. Yes.
His predecessor. But I also think he's been indecisive, and absent just some of the issues we've seen arise during the COVID pandemic and the response to it, I think the governor had a hard time getting big policy initiatives over the finish line.
Yeah.
I think if you look back at his first legislative session, you're not going to find a lot of big wins for this administration.
No.
And when you put a marker down and say, I'm betting my governorship on tolls.
Before an election cycle. Before an election. Never made sense to me.
But forget an election cycle. This is year one. And you are betting your entire administration on the success or failure of tolls. And you don't know you have the vote. And you can't even get your own team. Let's not forget, friends, the Democrats run everything in Hartford.
Yeah, and they had a visible, Liz, case of nausea every time this was brought up to them.
So the accountability piece here, the checks and balances piece here is very frustrating for, I think, Connecticut residents generally. But I think when you're looking at the governor, you have to scratch your head and wonder if this is his – He has been unable to get big ticket items on his wish list across the finish line.
Is that a product, Liz, of him just coming in largely as an outsider with a business background and not having been in the building for a few years at least?
Probably. I think making deals in the business world is a very different than achieving big policy outcomes. And there's an emotional piece and an irrational piece to the way public policy is made and it fails or succeeds.
Yeah.
And I don't think that that's something that resonates with people in the business world. Mm. A lot of times it's very linear and devoid of emotion. And so it's a very different thing getting into politics and running government. It's a very emotional business. And so it's not rational either. And none of it really makes any sense.
I don't think rational is the word. No. Liz, we're running short on time here. Thank you so much. Appreciate it. Liz Karanowicz, check her, Tom Dudchick, and all the other great folks this coming Sunday morning. News 8, it's the Capitol Report, the TV version of Tom's website, which, of course, has made him a major media mogul. How do you deal with Dudchick? Tom, if you're listening, calm down. Is he a man of the people, or does he still have an attitude?
He is the best. And by the way, big anniversary shout out to Tom, who reinvigorated the Capitol Report TV program 3 years ago today.
Yes. Yes.
So this is his 3-year anniversary, and running a television program like he does is no small feat. So a credit to him. I feel like Tom makes Connecticut politics come alive. I'm honored to be a part of it, and I think he's a great guy. So.
Well, tell him I said hi and stay away from the caffeine. Will you do that for me, Liz? Just tell him to calm down a little.
I get my extra jolt right before I go on just to make sure I'm wide awake and ready to battle.
To go with him, right? Liz Karanowicz, check her out Sunday morning at 10 on the Capitol Report on News 8. Liz, thanks. We'll talk in the future. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
You too. Liz Karanowicz there, the Capitol Report.
To be exact, it's 0.009953, so it's barely under 1%. Number I've tended to look at, and the death are lingering, which is disturbing. Next chart, I think you've seen many times. It's our total hospitalizations. It just wants to give you an idea of how much capacity we have in our hospitals in general, because the next slide will tell you what that could be at risk. The next slide shows you the adult ICU bed usage in Arizona and Florida. And I think you'll see that Arizona went from 50% availability to 100% occupancy in less than a month. And Florida ramped up, and they both have zero capacity at this point. They're moving people around. So it just reminds you why early on I cared so much about hospitalization in terms of capacity we have there. Obviously, right now we're blessed with a lot of capacity. And this chart just reminds you how fast it can change. This next chart is a little new one we've done. The new cases by age. We haven't broken it down by age before. I think you'll be interested to see that 20 to 29 is the biggest cohort in terms of years where people have tested positive for COVID. This is just in the last week. I will tell you, if you look over the extent of the last 90 days, 20 to 29 was not the highest in terms of age-related COVID, but it was only the fourth highest. And you look at over 80, you see where that is now. Before, it was the second highest. So it gives you an idea of how the COVID infection world is changing a little bit, where those, say, over the age of 50, their rate of COVID infections is going down as a percent of the total, I think reflecting on the fact that they're perhaps a little more serious about wearing the mask. And those in the 20 to 29-year-old cohort, that's where the surge in infections has been. And I worry about that because I think we saw that's how things started down in Florida and Arizona and other places as well. Just to tee up Scott, I'll tell you, it's been 24 hours of two sides of the same coin. I just met with the event planners via Zoom. It's hundreds of folks who make a living off of weddings and big banquets, and their business has been devastated. And they're just, anxious, pleading. What can you do? Let us get back. I got a big banquet hall. Let us have, a nice event. Maybe do some things. We'll be extraordinarily careful. And I just told them that we're leading every day with public health as the defining lens through which we measure everything. And I talked to Senators Murphy and Blumenthal today at an event. We said, look, there's a well over $100 billion in PPP, the Paycheck Protection money, still there on the books. They haven't been spent. We've done very good here. About 50% of all of our small companies have already gotten those loans. And all these event planners also got some loans as well. But as you know, as we move through July, those PPP loans are running out for companies like that. So I'm working with Chris in terms of how we can maybe make those PPP loans available to businesses that are still shut down for another period of time, so if people like the event planners can get a second winds, allow them to power through for the next few months, and hopefully things are turned around and they're available again. So anyway, the event planners, desperate to get back to work, and said everything we do, we got to do through a public health lens. We're going to have to wait a little bit longer. And on the flip side of that same coin, I spent a lot of time talking with teachers, which is where I want to focus a little bit today. You know, we put out our plan now. It's well over 2 weeks ago in terms of how we think we can get back to school safely. Number one, safety first, everything through that public health lens. We've shared that with the public health professionals far and wide, trying to get their best point of view on how we're doing and how I can convince parents and how I convince teachers that everything we're doing puts their public health first. You know, for the parents, we have a little more flexibility, as you know, because we're saying, look, if you don't feel confident with your kid going back to school at this point, we have stay-at-home options for them, and Nick Simmons is working on how we can get them the laptop, make sure you have a Wi-Fi zone and get you the access. So we've got pretty good capacity there. And there have been some early surveys coming out of Stonington and Fairfield and other places where it looks like probably 15 to 20% of the parents may want to take advantage of that homeschooling option to start off. And obviously that would open up more social distancing within the classrooms as well. And for the teachers, you've got to know I've got your back. Everything I've done to date, we've erred on the side of caution. As you know, when it came to reopening, we were slow to reopen. We waited for the metrics to be right. And if any state can open safely, I think it's Connecticut, given the fact that we still are under 1%, barely under 1%, under 1%. And I'm going to do everything I can to give you the confidence you need when it comes to masks, when it comes to disinfecting, when it comes to social distancing, when it comes to cohorting, to make sure that you know that you can get back safely, if it's okay by a doctor for you to get back. And with that, that's why I'm leading with the science. And as you remember, a couple days ago, we had Dr. Carter on board, chief epidemiologist from the state. Next week, we'll have Dr. Koh back, all opining on our plans as we reopen and what we're doing right and what we can learn from. And with that, I'd like to introduce or reintroduce to you Scott Gottlieb. Scott has been a leader on this COVID crisis since the very beginning, always erring on the side of caution, putting public health front and center, and working hard to convince all the major stakeholders how we can get this right. And I'm fortunate to tell you that he's a dad with kids in the Connecticut schools, and that's why he's taken a particular interest in our great state. Scott, any thoughts on reopening?
Well, thanks a lot, Governor. I appreciate the opportunity to be here with you today, and I appreciate the dialogue that we've had through this difficult time. I wanted to share some thoughts on schools. Yeah, this state's worked very hard with a diverse set of stakeholders to craft a plan that I think tries to lean forward for return kids to school for at least as far as we can get into the school year as possible, while providing for the safety of children and teachers and families. And, you know, these are, in my view, very hard decisions, maybe the hardest decisions we're going to make. And I don't think any plan is going to be perfect. And a lot of what we're going to do is ultimately going to depend on the circumstances that exist in the fall. And it's hard to predict where we're going to be with any certainty in the fall as this infection evolves around the country. But hopefully we're going to have the opportunity here in the state, and I think we will, to bring kids back, at least for a period of time. We may end up having to close the schools at some point in the fall, winter, as this epidemic takes its course, but we're going to have the opportunity to bring kids back. And I think even if we can bring them back for a period of time, that's going to be exceedingly important. It's critical for their education, their social well-being. It's important for families to try to get kids back into school. But it's important we do it with precautions to prevent outbreaks in the school setting. And we're doing that here in the state. with the plan that you put forward, Governor. And that means a number of things. It means parents should be given a home option, as you've said. I believe parents are in the best position to know what the risks are to their children. And some children are at higher risk than others because they may have asthma or other health conditions, and parents should have that flexibility as they will have in the state. I think it's important we keep social networks small, as you prescribed in the plan, have children stay with the same defined cohort. This is something that was done by European countries as well with success, and try to keep those cohorts as small as possible. So that way, if you get a single introduction of infection into a school setting, it mitigates the risk that there's going to be a large outbreak. Masks clearly reduce the chance of spread. They protect you from me, they protect me from you, and it's especially important in the school setting and that students be taught how to use them properly. I think it's especially important also for teachers who may be at higher risk from infection, that they should have proper protective equipment. We need to protect the teachers. They're really frontline providers in these settings. And while there's evidence that children are less susceptible to contracting the virus, the data is less certain is on their ability to transmit the virus. The data there is mixed. And while some studies show they're less likely to spread infection, other studies show they may be just as likely to spread the infection. So we need to make sure we're protecting the teachers in these settings. And we need to have humility about this virus and appreciate that we don't fully understand it. And we're learning a lot as we go. We've both underestimated and overestimated COVID along the way. And so we need to understand that there is risks that we don't necessarily understand. And then finally, final point, what we do is going to depend on the overall risk in the setting. We need to acknowledge that while the data shows children may be at less risk from COVID than adults, less risk doesn't mean no risk. And we've deliberately sheltered the children to date. And so the overall infection rate among kids may be rather low. And other countries that reopened their schools did it with strict measures in place. They did it against the backdrop where they controlled the spread. We face different circumstances in the U.S., so we need to be careful that we take steps, as we're doing in this state, to try to control outbreaks, acknowledging that we don't know everything about this virus, and we don't know everything about the risk to children in particular. So we need to be cautious and proceed with caution, and we're doing that. And so I just want to thank you for the opportunity to be here today, Governor, and try to be helpful to the state. I have a lot of confidence in what we're doing. My kids are in public school in the state, as you know. And I feel very good about what my local officials and state officials have done today to try to protect us all from this virus and address these risks.
If I could ask the first question, Scott, what can we learn from Europe, where I understand schools have been open in many cases for a month or two with very low risk of flare-ups, I mean, not flare-ups to date. But then I read in Israel there have been some flare-ups. What can we learn from those examples?
When you look around the world, different countries did different things. A lot of what they did with success or success to date are things that we're baking into the kinds of plans that we're doing in this state and other states are doing. In China, schools reopened early May, but children had to pass through temperature checks and wear masks and enter and leave at specific points. They controlled the flow of the schools. In the Netherlands, they cut class sizes in half, but they didn't enforce distancing measures. Other schools adopted a pod model or cohort model, as we're doing in this state. Denmark was the first country to reopen schools, and they did this. They assigned children to small groups that could only congregate with small groups. Finland kept classes normal size, a class size. They had students in those defined cohorts. Denmark became the first Western country to reopen schools. They were 15th. They maintained a sophisticated sort of monitoring system in their schools, try to detect any increased infection, identify the likely outsource, and also try to control social interaction in the schools. Israel, as you mentioned, reopened schools, had large outbreaks. They didn't do a lot to try to control cohorts or to de-densify their schools. And their schools are the sort of the physical plans of their schools. They're known to be crowded, and so it was a high-risk condition. And so a single introduction was able to lead to large outbreaks in that country.
Hey, well, thank you. And your kid may be downstairs on Zoom because your audio is breaking up just a little bit if you have connection there. But Max, any questions?
Fox 61.
Hi, Governor. Zania Maldonado from Fox 61. You mentioned that new cases by age just this week, biggest group ages 20 to 29. What's your message to that age group right now? And could you also talk about, is there the potential possibility that this age group could I don't want to say ruin things, but come September, really inhibit the success that Connecticut has had so far?
Well, I think the younger age group, like the 20 to 29, which has spiked up, as you point out, in terms of those infections, are a little more casual when it comes to wearing the mask and close contact socializing. So I think that is a worry. I know how frustrating it's been. I know now it's July. I know we haven't seen your friends in quite some time. You're making up for some lost time. But I'm just telling you, when you look at the numbers in Connecticut and you look what's going on around the country, especially in those southern states, that could be a canary in the coal mine. So please, please be very careful.
And then also in that chart, we saw that the second age group for new cases is 30 to 39. And the average age of the Connecticut teacher is, I believe, 30 to 49. So is there some concern around, you know, teachers, we're talking about it today, and them having a higher risk of getting COVID?
I think it's risky behavior that gives you those numbers. And, you know, the older you are, the more cautious you are, I guess. That's one of the things that comes with age. So when it comes to teachers, I'm less concerned because we are going to be so careful in terms of making sure those protocols are followed, starting with the kids as well as the teachers, the masks, and the other requirements.
NBC Connecticut.
Hi, Governor. Matt Austin with NBC Connecticut. A new poll out of Quinnipiac just yesterday found that about 60%, 62% of people said it would be unsafe nationwide to send students back to K through 12 schools. I mean, the school year is not that far off. How do you give that number of people the confidence to send their kids back so soon?
Well, when you say so soon, remember, we've had a couple weeks of 1% or less. We've had declining metrics for the last, couple of months. Let's say we started reopening a couple of months ago with some restaurants outdoor and stores. It was a month ago now that we did some indoor dining and some other venues. So I don't think it's so soon is how I would phrase it. But you're right. I'd be very cautious if I was down in Miami Beach right now about having my kid go to school, given the fact that they have an infection rate that could be 25 times are. We're in a very different situation, and I think that national poll maybe reflects some of that.
And then for a question for Scott, in terms of the number of states where we've seen such a spread of COVID recently, at what point do we have growing concern here in Connecticut that could transfer or spread cases here and especially affect the fall and the school season?
You know, it's hard to say. Anyone who thinks that they can predict the next 2 or 3 months with any precision, I don't think you can. I think at some point there's a risk that we're going to have a confluent epidemic across the United States because we have a lot of infection. We're taking an awful lot of infection into the fall, and it's going to collide with flu season when it's going to overwhelm our ability to do effective testing. I do think in this state, you know, in the Northeast, where we've sort of brought the levels down very low, we're likely to be quiescent for a period of time. I think we've bought ourselves a couple of months, probably, of low levels. But we're getting introductions right now, and eventually we're going to have chains of transmission. Now, hopefully we have enough testing and tracking and tracing in the state that we're going to be able to detect it early, try to contain outbreaks. But eventually there's going to be a risk that this becomes a confluent epidemic across the United States as we enter into the flu season.
And just briefly, can you give us an overview of where we are with vaccines? How confident are you that we're going to actually have the distribution also to get the vaccine out effectively? I know we've run into a lot of issues with testing.
I think we're going to have the ability to distribute the vaccine. You know, in 2009 with the H1N1 season, we effectively made a trivalent flu vaccine, and then we manufactured a couple of months or several months later than that a monovalent vaccine for H1N1 swine flu. And we were able to both manufacture and distribute that flu vaccine. So we had the capacity to basically create a sort of double supply of flu vaccine that season, get enough injections, be able to deliver it effectively. So we've done this before. We should be able to both deliver a flu vaccine this fall, winter, and then deliver a COVID vaccine if we're fortunate enough to have one. I think the reality is that having a COVID vaccine is likely an early 2021 event and sort of an optimistic scenario. I think it's unlikely we're going to have a vaccine available in 2020. If it is available, it's going to be available for limited use under an emergency use authorization, probably. That would be my best estimate. It's possible we'll have data from the pivotal trials with the vaccine sometime in October in sort of an optimistic scenario. And partly that could get accelerated because I think enrollment in these trials is going to go quick. There's going to be a lot of people who want to enter these trials. And frankly, the United States is unfortunately a very good place to be conducting a vaccine trial or a COVID vaccine right now because we have so much infection. We have a lot of cases. And so these trials are going to be able to determine more efficiently whether or not these vaccines are effective because you're going to have a lot of cases in the control arms of these trials to know whether the vaccine's working. So we could get an early answer on the vaccine. And the final point is, remember, the manufacturers are manufacturing these vaccines right now, or they're going to start manufacturing them at risk. And I'm on the board of Pfizer, as many of you know, which is one of the companies with the vaccine. But the manufacturers have said publicly they're manufacturing these at risk. So we're going to start having supply and doing lot release, maybe as early as late summer with these vaccines. So by the time one of these is either authorized or approved, you're going to have some supply on hand that you can start distributing.
News 8.
Governor, we understand that things could change pretty drastically over the next couple of weeks. But is there a scenario where we get into August, we have not gone into phase three yet, but is there a scenario where you would still maybe have school start on time with as many kids in class? Or would that phase three, if it's still not still in pause, then you wouldn't look to go forward?
I think those are two separate items. Phase three, as you remember, was bars, nightclubs, occupancy and indoor dining. And those are things we decided to put on pause because we thought, talking to every other governor in the country, that those are very infectious, especially in the bars. I would not put the schools in the same category at all. I think we have a situation where we can control it a lot better. We can cohort, as Scott said, and we can make sure that masks are required. And I think that will make it a very different environment than the other phase three.
Can I ask you a question about with respect to the lottery as well? I know there had been talk in the past couple of years about going online, and certainly maybe during this time, it looks pretty good. Is that something that will come up again in the near future?
Probably come up not in a special session, but perhaps in the regular session. We've had a number of conversations with both Mohegan Sun and Foxwoods. Thinks this is a good time to be thinking about the iLottery, but there's some legal things we have to make sure we do it in a way that doesn't invite litigation.
Channel 3 Eyewitness News.
Yes, question for the governor. Last week we talked about air filtrations in schools, possibly adding HEPA filters or UV light. Have strides been made during this week to kind of get these things in the schools?
Yeah, let me start with that. Then maybe Scott and Josh can help out. It's regarding air filtration systems. And we are out there doing an analysis of all the schools right now, seeing the nature of their airflow and what type of filters we might be able to get installed, because we think it could make a difference. And I think it's going to probably take us another, 2 or 3 weeks to get a response on that. But do you guys have any thoughts on the level of importance on air filtration? Maybe Scott?
Yeah, look, I think that this is something that could be helpful and would be important if it can be achieved. I mean, the fact that kids are going to be wearing masks and teachers will be wearing masks in the schools mitigates the risk, but the filters would certainly be another additive measure that could be taken. The reality is we talk about COVID being airborne, whether or not it's aerosolized or whether or not it's droplet transmission. And the truth of the matter is that what it probably is droplet transmission that in optimal circumstances can spread through means that approximates an aerosolized virus. It's not truly an aerosol virus like measles or tuberculosis, but under the right circumstances, it can spread through a pattern that looks a lot like an aerosolized virus. And what are those circumstances? Those circumstances are indoor settings where you have people in congregate settings, and you have poor air circulation, or you have air circulation that's sort of optimized for spread. And some people are speculating that maybe air conditioning units with, poor circulation can be sort of that optimized setting. That's what you see bars or other settings like that become the focus of outbreaks. And so anything we can do to improve air quality indoors and congregate settings is going to be important. And the HEPA filters and other kinds of filtration devices can certainly add to the measure of protection that you're affording students and teachers.